You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Welcome to today's Brookings event on the crisis in Ethiopia and its regional repercussions. I am Dr. Wonderful Bob Brown, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution and Director of the Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors and Co-Director of the Brookings Africa Security Initiative. The Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors seeks to advance policy-relevant knowledge of non-state armed actors and illicit economies in the United States and around the world. The Brookings Africa Security Initiative especially focuses on the variety of threats, security challenges, as well as peace dynamics on the African continent. As with all of Brookings' work, the predominant focus is on independent, objective, in-depth research that informs policy options and develops policy recommendations. The unfolding crisis in Ethiopia is of critical gravity. The military confrontation between the government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and the Tigray political leadership has brought the country to the brink of another civil war. The latest battlefield picture is of a siege of the Tigray capital Mekele by Ethiopian federal forces, with the federal government giving an ultimatum to the Tigray leadership to hand itself over to Addis Ababa. That ultimatum expires tomorrow. But even a military victory of the federal government may fail to quiet not just the Tigray-Addis tension, but also the broader ethnic strife and center-periphery tensions in the rest of the country. Already, the military confrontation has produced a grave humanitarian situation. The hostilities also pull in the wider region of Horn of Africa, including Eritrea, countries such as United Arab Emirates, and have large repercussions for what's happening in Somalia. I am joined today by an absolutely terrific panel that I will introduce in a moment for us to discuss these issues and a way forward. But before I do, I want to emphasize that when we were organizing the event, we made an extensive effort to bring in Ethiopian voices. We reached out to a good number of Ethiopian scholars and analysts, but they all declined for a variety of reasons to join the panel, including sensitivities about speaking publicly on those issues. We also sought other African perspectives and were thrilled when Mr. Murithi Mutiga, Project Director for Horn of Africa at the International Crisis Group, agreed to participate. Unfortunately, at the very last minute, he had to cancel. But we look very much forward to working with him and collaborating with him on events in the future, as well as to engaging with Ethiopian scholars. At least we will have Ethiopian voices in the question period. Many folks from Ethiopia have already submitted questions through the written functions, and I will take those questions when we move to that section of the panel. I am now delighted to introduce my colleague, Ambassador Jeff Felton, who is the John C. Whitehead Visiting Fellow in International Diplomacy in Foreign Policy at Brookings. Jeff was the Undersecretary General for Political Affairs at the United Nations in New York prior to coming to Brookings. And prior to that, Jeff had a very distinguished career also in U.S. diplomacy. He served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs and U.S. Ambassador to Lebanon. He retired from the State Department with the distinguished rank of career minister. Mr. Peyton Knopf is another very talented U.S. diplomat, currently a senior advisor at the U.S. Institute for Peace, where he focuses on the Red Sea region. At the same time, he is also advisor to the European Institute of Peace. Peyton has held a variety of U.S. diplomatic relations in sub-Saharan Africa, as well as at the United Nations, where he served as coordinator of the UN panel of experts on South Sudan from 2015 to 2017. He was also the spokesman of the U.S. mission to the United Nations under then Ambassador Susan Rice and held a variety of other diplomatic postings and diplomatic roles in the U.S. Foreign Service. And I'm also thrilled to introduce another colleague of mine, Zach Vertin, who is a non-resident fellow at Brookings And prior to that, Zach was a visiting fellow at the Brookings Doha Center. He too has served in a very accomplished way in U.S. foreign policy. He was the Obama administration's director of policy for the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan and South Sudan between 2013 and 2016. And he wrote a terrific book from those experiences called A Rope from the Sky, The Making and Unmaking of the World's Newest State About South Sudan. Zach also spent 6 years at the International Crisis Group in the Africa program and was an advisor on peace operations and multilateral affairs in the United Nations Security Council. Zach, let me start with you. Please explain to us, what is the latest situation on the ground? What is the gravity of the ultimatum? And importantly also, how did this crisis emerge? What are its sources?
Thanks, Fonda. Glad to be with you, and hello to everyone joining us from home. I will focus primarily on the last part of your question on the sources. With a country of 110 million people, it's often been said that Ethiopia is too big to fail, and I certainly share that opinion. Not only could this conflict spread to other parts of Ethiopia, but it endangers both the Horn of Africa as a whole, but also the wider Red Sea region. So I'm going to paint with a very broad brush to sort of set the table for us here as to where we are today. This conflict, in my opinion, is about power. It's about economics, and it's about competing visions for the Ethiopian state. It's about balancing stability and democratization, ethnic loyalties and national identity, and it's about a tension between the old status quo and a desire for change. When Prime Minister Abiy came to power in 2018, I noted at the time that he had finally taken the lid off of Ethiopia. And I think that lid needed to come off because the old system could no longer contain popular demands for change. So removing that lid meant initiating one of the world's most important political transitions, but it's also its most fragile. And I think what we're watching now is that project come dangerously close to disaster, and the potential consequences of a wider war or of chaos in Ethiopia really should not be underestimated. They already, in my opinion, constitute a threat not only to the Ethiopian people, but a threat to international peace and security. So the last 2 weeks of this conflict, we've seen no shortage of finger pointing about who is to blame, finger pointing both among Ethiopians, and for that matter, among those outside Ethiopia. But the reality is that both sides bear responsibility for the current state of affairs. Over the last 2 years, both the TPLF and the Prime Minister have put each other in a corner. So this conflict is about the TPLF's 27-year reign. It's about its often stubborn reluctance to let go of the power and economic influence which it so long enjoyed. There remains a lot of anger towards the TPLF among Ethiopians of many backgrounds for the way they govern the state, from stifling free speech to cracking down on dissent, locking up opponents, etc. And we've seen a lot of that anger manifest somewhat dangerously in recent weeks. But the conflict is also about Prime Minister Abiy's desire to turn the page on them, the TPLF, and about the ways in which he has done that. Now, for his advocates, his reign has meant upending the highly controlled state in Ethiopia. It's meant promising sweeping reforms, including greater freedoms and economic liberalization. But for his detractors, it's meant Abiy advancing of a vision of the state with far too little consultation among Ethiopia's broad and diverse society, and doing so, in their view, in excess of the transitional mandate that they believe he was entitled to. And most recently, it means for them, Abiy's government mimicking the kind of repression, the kind of tactics that he had promised to usher out. So I just want to emphasize that this is not just about Tigray versus the central government in Addis Ababa. Yes, that's the most intense right now. It's the most violent manifestation of it. But it's essential to understand that this is also very much about Ethiopia's 9 other federal regions and their attempt to renegotiate their place in Ethiopia in the post-EPRDF era. So this conflict is about a system of ethnic federalism, versus visions of a unitary state. It's about revolutionary democracy versus liberal democracy. And it's about division of the national cake. And again, it's against that backdrop that the war is now unfolding in Tigray. And it's a war that, in my estimation, no one can win. I think there will only be losers. And unfortunately, coming to that realization on the battlefield will mean, as we've seen in recent weeks, extraordinary human cost in terms of casualties, of destruction, refugee flows, et cetera. So I would argue, as is so often the case, that there is no military solution to this crisis. The only way out is a negotiated settlement, with both sides inevitably making some painful concessions. And while it's hard to envision that in the highly polarized context we're in, I do think it's possible. And to that end, last week for Brookings, I outlined a sort of three-point plan, the kind of foundational elements of a settlement, a baseline on which Ethiopians themselves and hopefully mediators can build and revise as necessary. And I'll come back to those later in our chat, but I just want to put them on the table here briefly. One is a cessation of hostilities. First, obviously, the fighting must stop and humanitarian access be allowed. And ideally, this should happen before any push on final, quote unquote, final push on Mekelle, the regional capital of Tigray. Second is going to have to be some kind of mutual recognition of legitimacy. Both sides have called each other illegitimate. To move the process forward, each side is going to have to recognize each other's legitimacy until new elections are organized. And I think a range of normalizing measures can flow from that, from restoration of funds to Tigray, federal funds to Tigray, to accountability. This can and should include fair trials and imprisonment and due process for those on both sides who have employed violence or committed crimes, or sought to subvert the state. And third is a political dialogue, really bringing all Ethiopians together, not only the federal government in Tigray, but Ethiopia's broad society from all 10 regions to set the terms and timing for new elections and a constitutional process to follow. So I'll stop there. And as I mentioned, I'll come back to this and put a bit more meat on the bone later when we talk policy options. Thanks
very much for putting a lot of very rich dimensions on the table in a very pithy way. You know, you spoke about no one will be a victor in the military confrontation, and certainly already the humanitarian situation is grave. There are perhaps 40,000 refugees in Sudan, many more internally displaced, and even prior to the crisis, Ethiopia was already suffering from some 2 million people displaced across the country, including in Oromia. And you're urging, of course, that the military confrontation can only bring bad things for the entire country, and the region is again taking place on the context of the threat by the Ethiopian forces to pounce on Mekelle. We have some very recent horrific examples of how urban battles go, most dramatically Mosul, of course, but Grozny is another example. None of us want to see any of that suffering. Peyton, if I can go now over to you. Zach used the term taking of the lid of Ethiopia. You, I, and Zach were on a similar panel on broader Horn of Africa at the very end of September. And you were speaking about Ethiopia, the explosiveness of the situation there, its various dimensions. And the notion came up that Ethiopia might be like Yugoslavia was before the explosion, the Yugoslavia analogy. With what has happened a month and a half later, are we further or closer away to the Yugoslavia analogy? Is that at all useful to think that way? In addition to giving us your take on what's happening in the Tigray confrontation, can you also speak more broadly about the center-periphery issues, ethnic issues in other parts of the country, Amhara, Oromo? Right now, they seem to be united in the effort to smash the Tigray leadership. Will that unusual alliance last? What are the other implications? What are the internal political dynamics in Tigray, but beyond Tigray?
Sure. Thank you very much, Vanda, and thanks for Brookings for having me this morning. You're right. I think to take us back briefly to the discussion that we had at the end of September, and I do think there are some eerie similarities to Yugoslavia, in fact. But I think there is one key difference that maybe is worth highlighting that we discussed then, and to your question, I think it remains very relevant now, which is that Yugoslavia imploded, and Ethiopia, and I think we're seeing that to some extent, is going to be explosive the longer this national political and security crisis unfolds. And I use the word national very intentionally because I think it's important to situate what's happening between the central government and Tigray in, as I think Zach was getting at as well, the broader national context, because it's symptomatic of a larger crisis and debate over over legitimacy and who has legitimate authority and who is adhering and defending the constitutional order of Ethiopia, and those who want to challenge that and think the constitutional order, as was constructed, you know, 2.5 decades ago, whether that's relevant or not. But before I sort of elaborate on that, I do want to answer your question, which is that I think what we're seeing, to the extent of refugee flows, the sort of internationalization of the conflict that I know Ambassador Feltman will talk about more at length, is this sort of explosive nature of the crisis that we're seeing in Ethiopia, which was less true in the Yugoslavia context, right? And I think it's important to bear that in mind. I mean, the analogy that I've used is that actually I think it's very hard to see this unfolding in a way that the neighboring states don't ultimately get sucked in. I mean, certainly they're engaged politically. The big question is the extent to which they are sucked in militarily. And that's a great, I think, danger, certainly for not just regional peace and security, but international peace and security. Maybe just to talk briefly about sort of the situation on the ground, as you asked. Look, this is day 21 of a law enforcement operation, as the government calls it, that was supposed to last a matter of days. And I think it's important that we keep track of that, right? Because as we sadly have learned from conflicts elsewhere, whether it's South Sudan or Yemen, other places on the planet, the current conflicts that are afflicting the globe have rarely gotten better with age in the last couple of years, right? And so it gets important for us all to keep our eye focused on the duration of this, because it's always very easy when governments and others have launched military campaigns to assert that they will be quick and decisive. And yet the preponderance of evidence, at least over the last decade, is that they have been anything but. And I think there's really no reason to believe, as Zach suggested, that that's going to be any different in this context. And I think that's deeply worrying. As you said, we've already seen significant refugee flows out of the country. I think it's worth noting that these are not just refugees leaving from Tigray. We're seeing refugees into Sudan from other parts of Ethiopia. And while it's a little bit unclear what that represents, because I think, you know, certainly sitting from afar, and I think we have to be humble about that, and given a lot of the communications lockdowns and the extent to which political and civic freedoms have been curtailed, not just in the last couple of weeks, but in the last, particularly in the last 5 or 6 months, really definitive information is hard to come by. But we do see refugees coming from other parts of Ethiopia than Tigray, which suggests conflict, instability, insecurity in other parts of the country, and I think again that should be deeply worrisome in terms of the trajectory of the state as a whole. We do also, as you said, Vanda, see several hundred thousand, up to I think at least half a million internal displacements newly in the last couple of weeks. That comes on the heels of, frankly, an internal displacement crisis that actually started in 2018. Ethiopia had the largest internal displacements on the continent of Africa in the 2018-2019 period. And again, I think we saw from that it was attributed primarily to political instability. And I think what that indicates is that, again, this is not happening in a vacuum. Excuse me. What's happening with Tigray is not happening in a vacuum. It's actually been building for some time. And I think that's important to note. I would also add and maybe stop with that, so I know we can elaborate on a couple of other things coming into this. I think we need to not lose sight of the, as we look at the sort of national political and security crisis, the national economic crisis. that's been facing this country. Even prior to this war in early October, the IMF was projecting 0% GDP growth for Ethiopia in 2021. That is down from 9% in 2019, which dropped to 1.9% this year, primarily because of COVID and the pandemic, but for other factors as well. And so when the country is already headed into a pretty nightmarish, frankly, economic scenario in 2021, and we know, of course, from other experiences, how devastating conflict either in a one localized area or nationally can be for the economic health of a country, and indeed for even some of the assistance that will be required externally to mitigate that, because obviously the humanitarian demands are escalating by the day, and resources, as we all know, internationally are finite and stretched. That's, I think, a pretty devastating scenario for Ethiopia, a country that just to keep pace with demographic growth has needed to add 2 million jobs per year, right, which it wasn't doing prior to the onset of hostilities between the federal government and Tigray. It wasn't doing prior to the instability we saw earlier this summer after the assassination of a popular Oromo singer and a lot of unrest that broke out of that. And so as we then head into this, what is projected to be an even steeper economic decline for a number of other reasons, and you think about just the expenses that the federal government and others will incur to fight whatever you want to call it, a law enforcement operation or a conflict, it's pretty hard to see how that economic decline doesn't spiral further. And that, of course, has, and I think can predictably have really devastating political and economic consequences that will further exacerbate the really significant polarization that we've already seen, obviously quite evident in the current situation. So I'll stop there, and I know we'll have the opportunity to come back and talk a little bit more, as Zach suggested, about maybe some principles and ways forward.
Well, great. Thank you. I'm very glad that you brought in the economic dimension, which is indeed significant. Ethiopia, for much of the past 30 years, had one of the highest growth, population growth rates on the continent, an issue that was always very worrisome and troubling already during the Meles Zenawi era, the issue of how to keep young people employed as they are coming of age and joining or hoping to join the workforce was a key element of stability. And as you highlighted, this has now been severely compounded by COVID, from which many a country will not be able to escape as soon as a vaccine is available. A lot of the economic recovery will likely take much longer, and certainly human capital recovery will often take even much longer than that, as COVID forced people to liquidate a lot of their human development assets in rather profound ways. And of course, that has another dimension. One of the effects of lots of young unemployment of young people frequently is militias, ethnic militias, criminal militias, militias organized in other way, something that has been growing in Ethiopia over the past 2 years and that has deeper, longer roots. So perhaps that's another dimension we can come to. But I would like to now a little bit expand from the inner to the outer, to the explosiveness, and ask you, Ambassador Felton, to reflect on us, to reflect with us on the region, on the role of neighboring countries such as Eritrea, very important ones, as well as on what has been happening with international diplomacy in dealing with the situation so far. Jeff, if you can please unmute your mic.
Hard to believe that even after months of this, that one still has to say that. I apologize. It's an honor to be part of this panel, to be included with such experts such as yourself, Fonda, and Zach and Peyton. When I look at Ethiopia right now, I can't help but think about all of the conversations that we had in the United Nations during the time I was at the United Nations with member states within the Secretariat about the importance of prevention. Everyone agrees that it's far better to prevent a conflict than it is to try to resolve a conflict or to rebuild a country after it's been devastated by conflict. So prevention is sort of the mantra that people talk about when they're looking at countries that have internal tensions. But this is a classic example, a tragic example of why prevention is so hard in the international context and why prevention so rarely works when it comes to trying to prevent internal tensions from turning into conflict. I mean, as the previous speakers have all noted, that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed describes this as an internal affair, a police affair. And the international system, centered on the United Nations in terms of peace and security, was designed to prevent conflicts between states, to provide off-roads to conflicts between member states. And this is an example of what is a conflict inside a member state, where we can all term it as a threat to international peace and security, but the national authorities that hold the seat at the Security Council will say this is an internal matter. This is not an external matter. I think we all, we've seen it's very well known the antipathy that Asmara has for the TPLF. That's part of the basis on which the essayist Abiy Rapprochement from a couple of years ago was based. So I think all of us are watching with great concern what Eritrea's view toward this will be, what Eritrea's involvement will be. And there's been a lot of speculation about involvement from further afield. The United Arab Emirates has a very unique access in this region because they have good relations with Asmara, good relations with Abiy, good relations in Khartoum, good relations in Egypt. What is the UAE doing in terms of this? I mean, in theory right now, the drive should be toward some sort of mediation, some sort of negotiation leading up to those three points that Zach was talking about that he'll elaborate on further. Because right now you have the international community coming together behind an initiative that derives from the African Union. The African Union often talks about African solutions for African problems. And South African President Ramaphosa is currently the AU chair, occupies the AU chair. On November 20th last week, he met with Sahle Work Zewde, the president of Ethiopia, who was there, who went to South Africa as a special envoy from Prime Minister Abiy. And at the Prime Minister, President Ramaphosa announced an initiative with three mediators, three former presidents from Africa, President Chissano, President Johnson Sirleaf, President Motlanthe, asking for mediation. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, immediately backed this mediation. There's a very interesting and encouraging statement from Abdullah Bin Zayed, the UAE foreign minister, 2 days later, also backing the Ramaphosa initiative and calling for dialogue. You had the EU High Representative Joseph Borrell, who appointed a special envoy, Pekka Haavisto, the current Minister of Foreign Affairs of Finland, who has extensive experience and contacts in the Horn as his special envoy, to try to back the Ramaphosa initiative. You had a little bit later, the U.S. National Security Council last night indicated support for this. So the international community is coming together behind an initiative by the African Union that would provide mediation and lead to an actual dialogue process. The problem is that so far, Addis Ababa, Prime Minister Abiy has remained rather cold to this initiative. And this again illustrates the broader problem we have internationally when one tries to mediate or prevent a conflict from getting worse, which is that the member state sovereignty in these sorts of matters still matter. There's a very interesting development in New York overnight at the United Nations, which I think illustrates the type of tools we have to try to encourage Prime Minister Abiy to look more favorably at the regional international call for mediation. The three members of the African group who sit in the Security Council now, Niger, South Africa, and Tunisia, along with Saint Vincent and Grenadines, they call themselves the A3+1, a small bloc inside the Security Council, called for a Security Council briefing today, this morning, on the situation in Ethiopia, with an emphasis on the South African, on Chairperson Ramaphosa's initiative. Today, this morning, the A3+1 withdrew that announcement. That suggests to me that the request for a Security Council briefing was designed to exert a little leverage, exert a little pressure. Does Prime Minister Abiy really wish the Security Council to discuss what's happening in Ethiopia, or wouldn't he rather look more favorably at the type of African mediation proposed by President Ramaphosa? There's an added twist to that, which is that after the A3+1 withdrew their request for a briefing this morning, the European members of the Security Council retabled it. So right now, at the conclusion of another Security Council meeting, happens to be on Iraq, there's intended to be a briefing, closed door briefing, to Security Council members on the situation in Ethiopia. But one would hope that all of this regional and external encouragement of mediation would lead to an opening for the type of dialogue that would replace moving toward a Grozny-type military solution to the problem.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff, and we will come back to further opportunities for international engagement and domestic resolution. I will turn back to Zach in a few moments to give him a chance to elaborate further the proposals that he put on the table, that he prefaced and that were in his impactful Brookings blog. But before I do that, let me reflect for a few minutes on Zach's comments that what's different about Ethiopia, unlike Yugoslavia, is that we are not looking at an implosion, but rather than an explosion. And specifically, let me reflect on what the situation in Ethiopia means for Somalia. The focus of the region has been, the focus of the world and of the region has been on Ethiopia, and rightly so, because the situation, should it become a lasting and increasingly complex civil war, would be indeed disastrous. But Somalia is going through its own set of crises and very dangerous moments that are very directly impacted by Ethiopia. That sort of triple crisis is brewing over Somalia. The first dimension, the one that I'll come back to, is precisely the impact of Ethiopia and the role of Ethiopian forces in Somalia, both in its fight against Al-Shabaab, but also in its own very complex and highly fraught relations between the center and periphery, between Mogadishu and federal member states. And this immediate impact is taking place at the time where the center-periphery tensions are really at their highest in years, in a very long time, and where they already were explosive and did explode into violent encounters between federal member states and the Somali federal government over the past 2 years. And they are also taking place as Somalia is heading into parliamentary elections next month and presidential elections in February. That, like in Ethiopia, were delayed. Under the best of circumstances, the elections are difficult to execute. There are enormous threats of violence from Al-Shabaab, but also a smaller actor, but nonetheless, at least locally potent one, the Islamic State. But they are all the more complex in the current moment, where there is high chance that losers in the elections will reject the outcomes. And where many powerful presidents of member states in places like Puntland and Jubaland have very hostile relations with Somalia's president, Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, and do not pray for his re-elections. So that there is high possibility of both a violent rebellion like in Tigray against the outcome of the elections, but also a violent response by federal Somali forces, as there have been prior attempts to do so. And the third dimensions of this context is, of course, that the United States, the Trump administration, announced very precipitous withdrawal of the U.S. Special Operations Forces that are placed in Somalia, about 750 of them. That seems like a small number, particularly in comparison to our deployments in places like Afghanistan and Iraq at the height of the crisis. But nonetheless, the U.S. Special Operations Forces have had several critical roles. One is to support and train the special counterterrorism force called DANAP that doesn't have the capacity to defeat al-Shabaab, doesn't have the capacity to turn the strategic situation around, but nonetheless has been key to disrupting major terrorist attacks. Secondly, and very importantly, the role of the U.S. Special Operations Forces has been to enable drone and airstrikes. And while they are controversial and often generate or often are alleged to generate civilian casualties, and sometimes they do generate civilian casualties, these strikes have also been critical in preventing al-Shabaab from massing. Without them or in the decline of them, Shabaab will find it far easier to run over AMISOM bases or bases of Ethiopian and Kenyan forces that operate independently, not under the AMISOM rubric, let alone of Somali National Army and militias. And finally, both the presence of U.S. Special Operations Forces and the Ethiopian forces has been really critical for stiffening the spine of anti-Shabaab militias. Those militias are the primary actors, and with the exception of DANAP and U.S. Special Operations Forces, the only actor that still conduct offensive operations against Shabaab. Since 2017, AMISOM, as well as independent Ethiopian forces, have essentially been in garrison mode, rarely patrolling, but not certainly not conducting offensive operations. And we have seen a steady, systematic, and significant decline in security, with al-Shabaab nowhere as strong as in 2010, 2011, but far stronger than several years ago, having reached across the country, having the capacity to take over cities, even though it has struggled to hold cities, controlling roads, having extensive freedom of operation. And it is often said in Somalia, when I was there in January, that the reason al-Shabaab doesn't conduct attacks is because everyone pays al-Shabaab, or at least very many great actors paid al-Shabaab. And then attack is specifically precipitated when the payment is not delivered. So each time we have seen Ethiopian forces withdrawn, al-Shabaab has taken over greater territory, as well as murdered local government officials or local clan elders working with the government. And of course, if the Ethiopia crisis goes on long time, there might be significant pressures and demand to withdraw more Ethiopian forces that could bring about an unraveling of the AMISOM force. And already, as it is, the extensive purges and detention of Tigray government employees are also being manifested in Somalia, where Tigray officers and soldiers have been disarmed, placed in barracks under detention or shipped to Somalia. So shipped to Ethiopia from Somalia. So rather rapidly come February, March of next year, we could see very significant conflict exploding around Somalia, both pulling in Ethiopia, but also impacting Ethiopia and pulling in some of the same regional actors in very complex ways, such as the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and other actors. So stabilizing Ethiopia is both crucial for the people of Ethiopia, but it's also crucial for Somalia and the Horn. Zach, let me now go back to you. Stabilizing Ethiopia is crucial. How to go about it? You have sketched your core thoughts. Can you please elaborate them further and also deal with the challenge that Ambassador Feldman spoke about, namely that Prime Minister Abiy has so far not been responsive to the international diplomatic efforts and calls for a dialogue?
Sure. Thanks, Vanda. I'll make two contextual points on your questions about the calls for negotiations and then revisit the kind of three baseline points for negotiation in the context of the mediation that Ambassador Feldman has laid out for us. Just this morning, I asked a senior Ethiopian government official again about negotiations, and you get two familiar replies. And I think this may shed some light on how the rest of us, the international community, can try to push the parties towards talks. First, as Jeff and Peyton have both mentioned, a claim that this military campaign is a narrow law enforcement operation. Now, they're doing this both for internal and external audiences and for various reasons. And while there are individuals and groups responsible for violence, for corruptions, for acts trying to undermine the state, it's obviously patently false to characterize the situation now, complete with tanks and artillery and a military siege and tens of thousands of refugees flowing across international borders, reports of large-scale atrocities on both sides. It's very hard to call that a police operation. It's really a war between the state and one of its ethno-regional sub-states. Secondly, on the calls for negotiations, this official reiterated points made by others in his government that we've been hearing, that dialogue of any kind would create a false equivalence with the TPLF. It would lift them up. It would mean impunity. And I don't think that's right. Negotiations, halting this now and having a negotiation process can be entirely consistent with calls for accountability. Again, as I mentioned at the outset, there's a lot of anger about the TPLF for its period of repressive governance, its provocations since it was ousted from power, but that does not mean that prosecuting an all-out war, including civilian centers in Tigray, is acceptable either. It isn't. The military campaign, the threats, the civilian cost are doing a good bit to obscure the government's concerns about the TPLF and instead highlight their own overreach. So on the mediation, very quickly, I want to mention the Ethiopia's most significant foreign partner over the last two decades, which hasn't been mentioned other than by you, Vanda, in the context of Somalia, but we haven't really discussed yet in terms of Ethiopia, and that is the United States, which might have been an ideal broker or at least a very strong player behind the African Union. But it really worked itself out of the picture here in a way that's rather unfortunate. And that's due in part because of the Trump administration's unhelpful positioning in negotiations between Egypt and Ethiopia over the Nile waters when it threw its support behind Cairo. The administration really surrendered U.S. credibility there in Addis Ababa. And then sort of switching whole scale since the outset of the conflict, we've seen the embassy and the State Department seem to be mostly echoing the government's position that this is a law enforcement operation, as well as the military analysis that this will be over in very short order, which, again, I think we all agree here is incorrect. Now, fortunately, yesterday, we saw the National Security Council put out a new message saying that the U.S. supported a negotiated end of the conflict and supported the work of the AU envoys. Better late than never. I understand a call from the State Department reiterated the same to Addis Ababa, though it didn't necessarily come from a high enough level, and it certainly should. So with those two points of context, on the mediation itself, Jeff has outlined the African Union envoys. I do think a negotiated settlement is possible, especially as battlefield gains diminish, forces on both sides are stressed, resources dry up, and hopefully international pressure to stop the fighting continues to mount. I think just as one point of analysis here, and by no means a value judgment, I imagine both sides are going to want to claim some kind of win before they're willing to talk, politically, for domestic purposes. If for the federal government, Abiy pulls back the reins, but is able to arrest and charge some TPLF leaders for crimes committed. He could conceivably claim that he's responded to unlawful attacks and other provocations. For the TPLF, they can claim survival, that they held off the government's assault and were able to push for a broader dialogue. Again, I'm not supporting either of those. I'm just saying I think that could be a point of context as the mediators begin to approach that. Now, on the ideas themselves, again, these are based on conversations with Ethiopians, both inside and outside the country, and Ethiopians on all sides. I'll just revisit those now. And again, I think these are points that could serve as a baseline for the African Union envoys. The first, again, is a cessation of hostilities. This would include redeployment, questions about control of the Northern Command that's at the center of this conflict, a monitoring mechanism to prevent flare-ups between now and new elections, humanitarian quarters, etc. In the long run, security forces, including military, police, irregular militia, of which there are many, will need to be restructured. But that's a conversation for the after the elections and based on a new constitutional dispensation. Second is the hard one. I mentioned this at the outset, some kind of mutual acknowledgement of legitimacy. As the idea the Tigrayan regional government could acknowledge the legitimacy of Abiy's government in a transitional capacity and tell the convening of national elections next year. In turn, Prime Minister Abiy could acknowledge that the mandate of Tigray's regional authority by way of its September 2020 elections could be accepted as the legitimate transitional authority as well. Now, I think the outer bounds of these respective authorities could be delineated. And as I said, normalizing measures could flow from this kind of mutual declaration. That would include restoration of federal funds to Tigray, the turning back on of the lights, the telecommunications and trade links, release of political prisoners, and as I've mentioned a few times, accountability for violence and other crimes committed during the transition period to date. Again, I agree with Peyton and Fulier. This is not only about what's happened over the last 2 weeks, but it's what's happened over the last 2 years, and not only in Tigray. And I think this can and should be put in that larger context. And that brings me to the third and final point, and that is dialogue, a political dialogue starting now before elections. So a renewed political dialogue addressing both the terms, the playing field in which elections could take place, and the timing as well. It can expand on some existing efforts towards dialogue, again, and involve not only Addis Ababa and Mekelle, but leaders of all 10 federal states and Ethiopians of all backgrounds, politically, ideologically, et cetera, the path to new elections, a new date, and some kind of constitutional convention to decide what changes will be made to the 1995 constitutions so as to resolve those core questions I outlined in my opening remarks about the nature of the state. That's not kind of comprehensive. It need not be something that be imposed from the outside, but again, a baseline to begin those conversations. These things always appear impossible until they aren't, and it requires the united front from the international community that Jeff mentioned to continue to press the parties to stop and go to the negotiating table. Thanks.
Thank you, Zach. Peyton, if I can turn to you for your take on policy recommendations and perhaps also some of the deeper issues. So one set of policy recommendations is, of course, resolving the immediate military conflict and starting to have capacity to deal with the humanitarian situation, which is dire, and yet humanitarian aid has not been able to flow. But the larger issue is the one how Ethiopia, just like Somalia, resolves the balance of power between the capital and the regions, and how that can be done in a way that prevents instead of encourages other conflict. Your thoughts on any of those issues, please.
Thank you, Vanda. Yeah, let me offer two maybe points to respond to your question. Then if I may briefly zoom out, because I'd like to pick up on something that you mentioned with respect to Somalia and sort of the broader changes in the region and the extent to which Ethiopian foreign policy has actually changed, I think, fairly substantially over the last 2 years as well. In terms of sort of the political, a political initiative going forward, I think there's the way I think about it actually is maybe in two particular ways. I think there was a very interesting piece this morning by former Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn that I think raised the sort of, it was essentially an argument against power sharing. And I think we have to be clear as we think about what sort of political formula might be the way out of this military confrontation, that we don't think that power sharing is the only answer for ending a conflict. We have sort of broadly, internationally speaking, somehow fallen into this trap that power sharing formulas are the only ways that one can construct a political settlement. And I think it's important very much to Zach's point, which I agree with, the formula that he's laid out. But I think, you know, there is, maybe power sharing isn't the relevant formula out of the current confrontation between the federal government and Tigray. I think, frankly, probably it's not in terms of coming up with something that addresses the nationwide political crisis that we've been talking about. But that does not mean that a political solution isn't possible, right? What it means is that we have to be very creative and think about, broadly speaking, how the underlying issues and drivers of the national political and security crisis can be best addressed. And if that's not power sharing, I think that's a perfectly reasonable argument to make. But that does not mean that a military solution or a law enforcement operation is the only way forward, right? What it means is that, you know, creativity and some political imagination is important and needs to be brought to bear. The second point that I would make is this question about sort of the constitutional order. And I want to say first and foremost that I would commend to everyone a piece that my colleague Ali Virgi from the U.S. Institute of Peace just wrote for our website actually this morning about this question of elections, because I think there's this there's an argument that has been made, I think primarily by the government, but is also circulating internationally, that, you know, you have a law enforcement operation and then the elections that were delayed because of the pandemic can sort of quickly be held, you know, in March or April. And therefore, you will then, via those elections, restore the sort of legitimacy of the various parties. And politics aside, and the need for sort of diplomatic solution, as Zach and others have laid out, notwithstanding, I think we have to be very clear-eyed about the technical barriers to holding elections in that time frame, right? And I think that also argues then for what are some other mechanisms for dealing with this crisis of legitimacy that affects many actors, many of the political stakeholders in Ethiopia at the moment, outside of elections, because I'm not sure that's a viable way forward in the time frame or along the time horizon that we're talking about here. I think it's equally imperative that whether it's Western powers, the United States, whether it's multilateral actors, whether it's the initiative by a very important initiative, as Ambassador Feltman mentioned, by the African Union and President Ramaphosa, there's a clear message conveyed to all Ethiopian political stakeholders that the Ethiopian constitutional order cannot be changed by force in the interim, that is only a recipe for further polarization, further violence, further breakdown of the state, frankly, and of the arrangement and the very fraught, clearly, relationship between center and periphery. USIP, I think as folks know, was honored to facilitate a senior study group for the last year and a half, of which Ambassador Feltman was a part of, on peace and security in the Red Sea. And the report came out about a month ago, and just before, actually, this conflict broke out in Ethiopia. And the group also issued a statement making this point that the constitutional order cannot be changed by force or by fiat. And I think it's really important as an international community that we not lose sight of that. The last point I would make just quickly on your humanitarian question, Vanda, is clearly there's an enormous humanitarian crisis unfolding in the country. I think, you see lots of numbers and projections thrown out there. I think everyone should prepare themselves. I very much agree, of course, that there's not a military solution. I think to the extent that a military campaign in Tigray or elsewhere unfolds, we should prepare ourselves for a humanitarian crisis that is of a scope and scale that, frankly, the international community has not seen in some decades. I think I mentioned this when we had the event at the end of September, but just to remind, Ethiopia is five times the size by population of pre-war Syria. So this notion that even 200,000 refugees, could come out and that can sort of be planned for, I think is a significant underestimate. It's also critically important that we recognize that humanitarian corridors are not the answer here. There needs to be unhindered humanitarian access that is predicated on need and urgency. not on a negotiation about certain access points with the government. That's not going to be effective, and it's frankly not consistent with international humanitarian law in this context. And then just finally on the region, I think what we haven't talked about today, and probably merits its own event, is the sort of revolution actually in Ethiopian foreign policy that Prime Minister Abiy has engineered. And I think you mentioned Somalia, Vanda, and one of the things that strikes me is Ethiopia for many decades, certainly even prior to the EPRDF regime, had prided itself on multilateral engagement, right? Whether it's the UN system and the important role it's played in peacekeeping going back to the Korean War, whether it's Ethiopia's leadership in IGAD. And you've seen a real sea change in that, right? There's a real tension between IGAD, for example, and whether Ethiopia is invested in that or not, vice a different arrangement between Ethiopia, Somalia and Eritrea in sort of a new regional confrontation. There had been, at least up until the last 2.5 years, a certain role played by the states themselves of Ethiopia in foreign policy. So certainly Tigray with respect to Eritrea, but also Amhara region with respect to Sudan, the Somali region with respect to Somalia. They had a role and a voice in how Ethiopian foreign policy was conducted. And similar to a number of the other political developments we've seen domestically, I think we've also seen an attempt to centralize foreign policy making, frankly, in Addis, that is a bit different and a significant change actually from the past. And I think that's worth noting because it does have ramifications, for example, with respect to Ethiopia-Sudan relations, a very contested border there between Amhara region and Sudan. And so as we look at a political formula, a political process with international backing led by the African Union, I think it's also important to recognize that Prime Minister Abiy tends to approach foreign relations very differently than his predecessors. And that's not necessarily criticism. It's just that I think it informs and in some ways is illustrated by, as Ambassador Feltman pointed out, how action in the United Nations has unfolded. It's indicative to some extent, as you rightly noted, Vonda, about the withdrawal, at least of Tigrayan elements of some of the peacekeeping forces in Somalia. UN had it or AMISOM had it, peacekeeping forces. So I think, you know, this is a different to some ways, the scope and change of Ethiopian politics has been hard to keep up with domestically, but there's been an equally profound change in Ethiopian foreign policy in the last 2.5 years. And so I think we all have to play catch up to that as well as we think about what the appropriate and constructive role is, either of regional actors with Ethiopia's neighbors or international stakeholders further afield in a political process.
Right, thank you. You know, several things you said, Peyton. The role of federal states or regions in foreign policy, major echo in Somalia, of course, including the contestation over who has a right to conduct any dimension of foreign policy. And also the issue of the electoral timetable. Are elections in March in Ethiopia realistic? And our elections in Somalia in December and February realistic? I'll come to those points in my few key points of recommendations. But before I do that, Jeff, if I can turn to you, please, for your policy advice on either the next steps or larger frameworks and visions, possibilities of how to address the deeper issues in Ethiopia and prevent an emergence of a conflict of a similar kind in other parts of the country.
Thanks, Vanda. You know, I've heard people talk about Ethiopia and whether, and this gets at perhaps the power sharing point that Peyton was making, that power sharing is traditionally described as not always the right solution. Because people have asked me, Jeff, you were ambassador in Lebanon. Is a Lebanon-like solution a good idea for Ethiopia? And I would say absolutely not. That what the Lebanon-type sectarian approach has meant is that yes, it stopped the bloodletting of the Lebanese civil war, but it froze it actually converted the conflict into one that was a competition that froze in place the sectarian divisions in a way that encouraged warlordism, corruption. It basically paralyzed the system. And it took, and of course, we've seen Lebanon collapse politically, economically over the past year. And so I would say that the type of rigid sectarian system that Lebanon had is not the right solution for Ethiopia. And we've seen similar things happen, with dysfunction in Iraq. It basically locks, that sort of thing locks in place a dysfunction to the system that's then hard to break out of. I've been thinking, Vanda, about if I were still at the UN, what's the UN agenda right now that could try to promote a more momentum toward the toward cessation of hostilities, mutual recognition and dialogue that Zach, I think, has very sensibly outlined. And part of it is, what is really happening? We don't really know for sure what is happening. We don't have access to the conflict areas in a way that would provide the information we would need to be able to make judgments. And all of us are hearing contradictory information. We're all hearing this happened, that happened, and we have no way of confirming it. So I would want to try to get people, if not on the ground, at least nearby, or at least make the appearance of trying to deploy people. This not only would, if it works, give us access to information that we don't have now about what is really going on, it would also raise the pressure on the parties, realizing the international community is not going to simply avert its eyes. It's going to try to keep watching and moving. That might increase the pressure for cessation of hostilities and dialogue and mediation. For example, I think that one thing that the UN could call for would be for a emergency joint mission of the human rights rapporteurs. Imagine if you had the special rapporteur for extrajudicial summary or arbitrary execution, that's Agnes Callamard, with the special representative for the right to food, since humanitarian access and food seems to be weapon here, who is a Lebanese, Michael Fakhri, along with the special representative of internally displaced persons, who's Filipina, and a special representative on contemporary forms of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance. If you had a high-profile emergency joint mission of these four special rapporteurs, if they didn't have access to Ethiopia itself because of sovereign concerns, perhaps they could be talking to the people who are leaving Ethiopia, the refugees. That would raise attention, raise a type of spotlight that would put those that are looking at military solutions, they're looking at purging institutions under some pressure. And these rapporteurs are relatively independent once they've been given their mandate by the Human Rights Council. I don't think that they need a Security Council blessing or anything like that. They can decide on their own, assuming that they have travel budget for that. You also have an acting special representative for the prevention of genocide, Pramila Patton. None of us would say that right now we would say definitively there's genocide taking place. But if you look at the hate speech, at the incitement, at the purging of various institutions, one could say that one needs to prevent this from turning into genocide. So the acting SRG for the prevention of genocide for the UN could be making statements, trying to travel, looking at what to do. There's also the special advisor on responsibility to protect, the R2P, Karen Smith, who happens to be South African. There's also a special representative. There's also the Secretary General special representative for the Horn of Africa. The UN has tools if the UN would choose to use them. The Secretary General on his own could create a fact-finding mission. This has happened. This happened after Benazir Bhutto's assassination. It happened after Gaza wars, where the Secretary General, using his own authorities, created a fact-finding mission. These sorts of things can not only help reveal what's actually going on, but put pressure on the parties to move toward talks rather than war, because they don't want to be investigated by this stuff. And of course, you've also got the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, Amina Mohammed, who is African, who's very much a proponent of that phrase, African solutions for African problems, who could be deployed. I also note that the current Secretary General, in one of his first acts in office, created a high-level advisory panel on mediation. That high-level advisory panel on mediation includes some very prominent Africans, including Ramtane Lamamra, who leads the Silencing the Guns initiatives for the African Union, was former African Union Peace and Security Commissioner. It includes former Nigerian President Obasanjo, who I think would be a very effective advocate for moving away from a military approach. It also has several others. So I believe that member states of the United Nations need to start putting pressure on the UN, on the Secretary General and others to deploy the tools that already exist, to try to bring us the information that we would need to better understand what's actually happening, and to put pressure on the parties by shining this international spotlight in a way that might help unlock that door towards cessation of violence, recognition, and dialogue that Zach has outlined.
Well, thanks very much. You know, the issue of the UN role and regional engagement is also key for Somalia, where an immediate critical dimension to me seems to be real need to engage both President Mohamed and other Somali politicians, particularly those in opposition to him, such as Jubaland's President Ahmed Madobe and Puntland's President Dani, but as well as clan elders, not to use the elections and its outcome, however frustrating, into opportunities to resolve or at least advance their agenda of center-periphery tensions through violence and arms. We are hearing various rumors about multiple forms of arming up going in Somalia, including among clans in Mogadishu. That is significant. President Mohamed has also built up his own nominally non-armed corps, more of a political cadre in Mogadishu, but one can imagine how that could slip into arming up as well. And now that is difficult because there is no regional consensus. The United Arab Emirates is close to the governments in Puntland and other regions of Somalia. Kenya has supported Jubaland and Ahmed Madobe, while Ethiopia has closely supported President Mohamed and has helped President Mohamed violently confront his opponents. So the chance that any kind of electoral violence will escalate into potential violence among regional actors is not insignificant. And already in the spring, Kenya and Ethiopia came really very close to blows in Jubaland precisely over these issues, even though they are both also part of AMISOM. Now, the second point I would like to make to connect with Peyton's comments, there is good reason to postpone the elections in Somalia by a short amount of time. And what I mean by that is something like 2 or 3 months. This could not be done by fiat. This could not be just declaration from Mogadishu, but would require consensual agreement from other Somali leaders. Why? Because the elections are absolutely unprepared. They are to take place in 2-3 weeks. Yet neither the broader setup, issues of how disputes are going to be resolved, or the physical organization of voting for the electoral colleges has really been completed. And there are virtually no security plans for holding the elections. In the prior elections, AMISOM was an important actor. The role of AMISOM today has been very much hands-off, distant approach. Some thinking towards securing elections has been done, but it's very much it's very incomplete and really inadequate given the immense violent dangers that can take place. And finally, the Trump administration is rushing to withdraw the U.S. Special Operations Forces. That may not be changeable at this point, but nonetheless, if there is any scope to delay that withdrawal, at least after the Somalia's elections take place, that would be highly desirable. And then we can have another event and mile of whether U.S. Special Operations Forces should or should not stay in Somalia at the, for a longer term. But the current withdrawal is really just the worst time to pick for the withdrawal, and clearly adopted without really paying any attention to the repercussions for Somalia's safety. Zach had a very important piece on way forward in Somalia, in Ethiopia. I had two blogs on Somalia over the past few days in which I go into further steps, not just the immediate ones, but also medium term. But I'm not going to go into those and instead now go to questions from the audience. The questions were submitted by email at the time of registration, subsequently sent in, and they have also been coming in as we have been speaking. There are right now about 60 questions that obviously we cannot go through all of them in the remaining 20 minutes of the talk, but I will bundle sets of questions together and pick those that have not been explicitly addressed. And since we were just talking about the region, let me start with the regional question for all of you. There are specifically questions about what is the impact on Sudan, but also whether Sudan has tried to be involved in the Tigray Addis crisis. Related question, similar question, what is the role of Egypt in all of this? Has Egypt engaged in any kind of active diplomacy or indirect support? To whom, how? And a whole set of questions that raise the issue of Egypt and the Great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, whether this is an opportunity for Egypt to try to sabotage the filling of the dam, or conversely, how does the internal crisis impact on what will happen with the dam? So, you know, Egypt, Sudan, and any other regional dimensions that you would like to bring. Perhaps you can just unmute. I saw Zach coming online. Zach, let me go to you first.
Sure. I certainly think we all agree on the very real regional implications. And, you know, the fact that Ethiopia is the kind of political and economic and security linchpin of the entire region is really not just a nice talking point. If we think of the immediate region, Eritrea, Sudan, as you mentioned, Somalia, Djibouti, Kenya, all of these states are connected by very real issues, land, resources, water and electricity, trade, economics, security, and ethnic overlap across every border. So any weakening of the state in Ethiopia inside or conflict spillover outside, I think will invite very real changes in these border regions and changes with regard to national foreign policy at the level of capitals, possibly even involvement directly in Ethiopia's conflict, as we've already seen in different ways, directly or indirectly from Eritrea. Your point about Sudan, I think we could talk about it at great length, given its unique position. Tigray is obviously cut off from the outside world by Eritrea to the north and opposing regions inside Ethiopia. And so they're in very real trouble in terms of logistics, in terms of food, in terms of supplies. And that impacts, as we know, not only the TPLF and their ability to fight, but also ordinary populations. So Sudan, and whether or not it opens that border officially or unofficially, what is let in and out is a very real variable, very important variable in what we see going forward. Then just briefly zooming out, and this has been referenced a bit, but zooming out and we look at Ethiopia in an even wider context, this sort of broader Red Sea region, and this is the project I work on specifically at Brookings, there is a huge amount of additional investment in each of these areas in Ethiopia. If we think about Turkey, Turkey has more economic investments in Ethiopia than anywhere in the region, and we've seen them engaged with Ethiopian leadership over the last week. The UAE, as Jeff outlined, bailed out Ethiopia's economy, helped out with foreign reserves early in Abiy's tenure. They've really tried to cement a relationship there. The UAE has this military base in partnership with the Saudis right next door in Eritrea. which they have likewise underwritten with cash and investments. The Qataris have sought to improve their own relations in Ethiopia, and huge numbers of Ethiopians, lest we forget, were before this conflict already flowing, and I think Peyton may have mentioned this, huge numbers of Ethiopians were already flowing across the Red Sea to Yemen and beyond, making their way to jobs and or safety in other places across the Gulf. And last, but far from least, as you mentioned, is Egypt, of course, and the Cairo being locked in a contest over control of the Nile with Addis Ababa. I don't know. I'd welcome others' thoughts on this. I think that would be a very dangerous calculation for Ethiopian security or intelligence to try to take advantage of this. I wouldn't be surprised, but I think it could prove especially dangerous. I think it's hard in some ways for any Ethiopian faction to sort of link up with Egypt on this, in part because the dam is such an issue of national pride and of national identity and was championed in the first place by the TPLF itself. So I think that is definitely something to watch and something with potentially huge implications, but I think it's hard. I don't see an easy path to that. I'll stop there and leave to others.
Thanks. Peyton and Jeff, please come in, but Zach's remarks just now and his mentioning the work at Brookings on Red Sea also brings to mind China, which obviously has sought to expand its role in Africa, including in East Africa. There have been talks of the scramble for Africa. China has a presence in Somalia, and obviously, as was said multiple times, Ethiopia is the linchpin of Horn of Africa securities. And if Ethiopia were to unravel, this is sending shockwaves throughout the entire region. What has China's role been in any of this? Jeff or Peyton, to either of you.
I mean, I frankly don't know. I mean, those of us who have been to Addis have seen all the cranes. We know how deeply China is engaged in terms of investment. I'll just make a general comment, Vanda. China, seeks markets. China seeks resources, and this tends to be easier in times of stability. And so, I can't imagine that China would want to see a type of collapse of Ethiopia that, picking up on what Peyton said, would make Syria look like child's play, because that would not be in China's interest in trying to access markets and access resources.
If I can just respond and engage you a little bit, but of course, China at the same time holds the position that what happens internally is the business of governments. We should not be, we the international community should not be messing in internal affairs. And China itself does not shy from using a mailed fist approach to a much lesser mobilization internally, such as in Xinjiang, than what we are seeing in Tigray. You know, this business of you do what you want, and at the same time we want stability, is often grossly in tension, and it seems to be critically in tension in what's happening in Ethiopia. What kind of dilemmas or opportunities does this pose for China?
I think that probably in the Security Council context, this is a real dilemma for China, because you're right. China does not. China very much opposes, external interference in the internal matters of member states. And China, in fact, is always looking for ways in the UN context to change terminology that we would interpret as defining internal governance. Say rule of law. When we say rule of law, we're talking about how do governments treat their citizens. China, in a UN document, will always insert between states after the term rule of law. So China tries to change the debate from rule of law, meaning internal rule of law, to how states treat each other in the UN context. So yes, China's instincts would be, do not question Prime Minister Abiy's description of this as being police action, internal security. The problem, though, is China aligns its positions in the Security Council with the A3, with the three elected members from the African continent who go into the UN for 2 year into the Security Council for 2 year rotational tours. So it looks as though we have a situation where the A3 with South Africa on the Security Council until the end of the year. South Africa unfortunately rotates off the Security Council at the end of the year, but we have the A3, Africa, Niger, Tunisia, as of last night. Of course, they withdrew, wanting to have a Security Council briefing on the internal situation in Ethiopia. This would be against all Chinese instincts, but China wants to ally itself with the A3 always, because China relies on that relationship with the A3 to build up its own political capital in the UN others. So I think that there is a bit of a political dilemma for China in how they would look at this. Should it come down to the fact where they would have to choose between the A3 and Prime Minister Abiy?
Thanks very much, Jeff. And of course, China's role also goes back to the Tigray period, where a tremendous amount of land dispossession in Ethiopia, including in Oromia, took place for the purpose of leasing land to actors like UAE, like Saudi Arabia, and like China for food production, often leases that were 30, 40 years long, even longer, and at the time were generating social strife, violence, violent repressions, and were some of the underlying factors that brought the demise, ultimately, of the TPLF regime. Peyton, to you, with any further thoughts on the region, Sudan, Egypt, but also if you can start pivoting to another set of questions that we are getting, namely, what are some of the rule of law, as Jeff just phrased it, and not the way the Ethiopian government means it, actions in terms of the purges of all Tigray personnel from working at the airport in Addis, to the blanket censorship on any kind of media communication, to integrate the humanitarian aspect? What kind of internal accountability mechanisms on the government, not for past crimes, but what's behaving correct, what's behaving currently, what's happening currently, should be taking place. So the perspective of human security, if we can bring that in.
Sure. I think, as I think others have said, there is an absence of firm facts, right? But and certainly the government has denied to some extent that there's any targeting of Tigrayans, either government officials or private sector actors. But I think what that argues for, as Ambassador Feldman said, is clearly there is a trust deficit plaguing the country, right? So to the extent that, and I would hope that it would, the prime minister and those around him, as the leader of the country, would find it in his interest to address that deficit of trust across the board. I think they need to seek international capacities for doing that along the lines of what Jeff suggested, right? There's any number of tools, whether it's through the UN, through the African Union, through other states, where credible independent investigations can start alleviating the set of questions or the sort of ambiguity about what's happening, whether it's respect to ethnic targeting, whether it's respect to security incidents, et cetera, and serve as a foundation for verifiable fact as a step towards a restoration of trust and credibility. And that is going to be required for any for the restoration of the rule of law, but more importantly, for a plurality of Ethiopian citizens to believe that there is a basis for the rule of law, because that's very much, of course, contested. And the way that the military confrontation has unfolded, and the extent to which both sides, whether it's the federal government or the Tigrayan government, have made constitutionally based and legally based arguments, that it has essentially politicized the law, right? So we need to look at these types of mechanisms, as I think as Jeff laid out, and there are of course others, for how one can do that. I think that speaks to a broader point and frankly links to China as well, which is that what I haven't seen, and I'll stand corrected. I have not seen a Chinese endorsement of the law enforcement, quote unquote, operation, right? And in fact, what you haven't seen is any state in the international community endorsing the government's position on that. Now, I'm not saying that folks have condemned it either, right? But if I weren't sitting in Addis and looking around, I would see actually the fact that none of the neighbors, certainly the United States now, I mean, very clearly, the tweet from the National Security Council last night, European governments, multilateral institutions, even the Chinese, no one has actually endorsed the government's position on this question, with the possible exception of Eritrea. And I think that's very important to bear in mind, certainly for the prime minister and policymakers around him. And then if I may, just quickly on Sudan, because I do think it's important. Here is another country that is enduring a severe economic crisis. And the notion that we will see the kind of the continuation of the refugee flows that we're already seeing out of Ethiopia, and Sudan's ability to withstand that on top of its own humanitarian challenges. And as I said, I'm in a situation where you've seen, among other things, the value of the Sudanese pound plummet in the last 12 months, I think should be deeply concerning. So when we think about a humanitarian response, what we're actually thinking about, and I mean, this goes to the point of internationalization or not, what we're actually thinking about is really not just a response to the crisis in Ethiopia. I think we need to be contemplating what the broader humanitarian ripple effects will be in Sudan, in Somalia, as you of course know well, Vanda, because this isn't just going to stop at, you know, putting some Ethiopians in a couple of camps in eastern Sudan and being able to give them food and then, you know, sort of ring fence it. Instead, it's going to have these really tremendous aftershocks, I think, again, at risk of sounding alarmist, as we obviously saw in the context of Syria, right? I mean, the aftershocks, whether it's for Lebanon, as Jeff knows well, of course, Jordan, Turkey, elsewhere. And I think it's that scale and that enormity of the challenge that really needs to bring focus and an uptick of attention to what we're facing here.
And then let me add to the dire, envisionable scenarios, also already some existing reality. Even if there were not the current military confrontation, the region has been close to famine or really difficult security, difficult economic and humanitarian situation because of locusts, because of droughts, or conversely, very intense rains. It's really been dramatically precarious and dire in Somalia. And it is perhaps the distraction of COVID globally, and also the enormous impact of COVID globally, that we are seeing less reporting as to what, even without violence, the famine, food security, humanitarian dimensions in the region are. Peyton, before I go to Zach and Jeff also with the last question, one quick question to you about the Ethiopian election. So the delay of the elections was one of the immediate triggers of the current confrontation, the military crisis with Tigray, with President Abiy, Prime Minister Abiy deciding to postpone the elections because of COVID, and the Tigray leadership rejecting that and holding its own election despite Abiy's wishes in September, and being re-elected, and being re-elected very robustly, even though nominally no elections were supposed to take place. You were alerting us to the grave risks of holding premature elections, such as in March, whether it's violence or producing a hung and paralyzed government like in Iraq, that, or for that matter, Lebanon, that could easily go on for months and months and months with really no robust leadership capacity. What's your just quick take? Should elections be postponed? How? What should be the process? By what time frame?
I think you used the key word, Vanda, when you were talking about this in the context of Somalia, which is by consensus. And that's not what happened, actually, with the postponement of elections in Ethiopia. It wasn't done by consensus. There were legal arguments on all sides, and I'm not a lawyer. I won't break those down or analyze them. But I think what we're seeing are the after effects of a decision that was made in the absence of consensus. And so I think certainly no matter what decision is made on the next steps for elections, and frankly, this goes back to where we keep going, which is the need for a political initiative. It really is about restoring consensual politics in Ethiopia. And I must say, I think here, and I mean, you mentioned this earlier, one of the largest obstacles to that is that I think what we've seen, again, long preceding, frankly, this confrontation between the federal government and Tigray, is the prime minister's tendency to equate dissent with criminality. That is a pretty fundamental barrier to forging any sort of consensus, and really is just a recipe for sort of endless debate over who's wrong and who's right. And Zach said earlier, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around. There's plenty of responsibility to go around. Litigating that endlessly, certainly through force, is probably not going to take the country on a more stable course.
Well, thanks. Winding round at the end, we have about 1 minute to the close of the session. U.S. policy, and U.S. policy both currently for the next month and a half and in the Biden administration. How tough should the U.S. get? Freeze aid, deliver economic aid, deliver only humanitarian aid? In kind of 30-second responses, are some of the key elements? Zach, let me start with you.
Sure. I think, as I mentioned, a slight shift in U.S. policy recently. The key is that the United States can't be silent. The continued military campaign and the continued framing this as a law enforcement operation is only enabled by silence from historically Ethiopia's biggest foreign partner. So I think the United States needs to get more actively involved behind the African Union. And I will say, and it's not always easy to say this, I do think despite how difficult this looks right now, I do think there is a way out. I think because of what Peyton and Jeff have both outlined about the international community, how states have postured to date, what they have or haven't said, there is a relative unity, or at least a lack of disunity among external partners, which if we look at Syria or other conflicts that we mentioned, that's always been an exacerbating factor. At least right now, we don't have that outside of potentially Eritrea. But if you look at the U.S., the Gulf, the Europeans, possibly even China, as has been mentioned, it does seem to me there's potentially a way out. I think that depends principally on decisions taken in Addis Ababa over the next maybe days. And does the prime minister want to restore the kind of narrative that won him the Nobel Prize? Or is he going to create yet another cycle of repression in Ethiopia? Thanks.
Jeff. The elevator speech talking points on U.S. policy for the Biden administration on January 20th.
I mean, with the possible exception of Eritrea, as Zach said, there is an emerging international consensus behind what has to happen, at least in the broadest terms. The U.S. Can be the engine behind the African Union in uniting what is sort of a general approach toward ceasefire and mediation to something more specific. I don't think the U.S. should be conditioning humanitarian assistance unless suddenly humanitarian assistance a la Syria is being weaponized. But I do think that the U.S. needs to raise its voice to turn an amorphous consensus toward mediation into something specific.
Peyton.
I know we're over time, so I will just associate myself with colleagues' remarks. I mean, look, there's not a military solution to what is fundamentally a political problem, and as inconvenient and challenging as it is to engage in politics, it's necessary. And I think Jeff's exactly correct that it's going to take an engine of U.S. policy to drive that forward, not to define solutions, nor frankly should the African Union initiative to define solutions, but to ensure that Ethiopians are able to come to a consensus on their own on a different way forward.
Thank you very much, Peyton, for joining us again. Another stellar conversation. Very much thanks to you, like in our September event. I encourage everyone who wants to get even more deeply on the horn on Ethiopia to look up the link that's on web. Zach and Jeff, enormous thanks to you for your great insights and for being such wonderful and amazing colleagues in the initiative on non-state art actors and Brookings more broadly. And thank you very much, all three of you, for joining us today and sharing your insights. And very many thanks to the audience. We really value it and greatly appreciate that we got over 50 questions and that we had such robust participation, including from people who come from the region. We look forward to further conversations, and good day to all of you.